So I think we'll get started. Welcome to DePaul University. I'm glad you made it to the construction area downstairs. My name is Charles Strain. I'm a member of the Religious Studies Department and the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies program here at DePaul. And at DePaul, we believe that it's important that our students be exposed to a multiple worldviews, both religious and secular, and both of these departments are staffed to be able to bring multiple viewpoints. But we also are committed to making a contribution to our local community, and we do that through our Center for Interreligious Engagement. And that center is co-sponsoring this event today, and we're delighted to do so with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I think many of you may have noticed that we're in the Dorothy Day room of the Richardson Library, copies of the Catholic Worker. Dorothy Day, for some of you who may not know, is a longtime peace and justice activist from about the late 20s, early 30s, actually grew up here in part of her life on Fullerton Avenue, and was on the front lines for over 50 years in all the peace and justice movements in the country. So it's really apropos, I think, that we hold it in this room today. Tygen Dan Layton from the Ancient Dragon Zen Temple will introduce our speaker. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Charles.
I'm not going to use the podium. Okay, but you can.
I will.
Okay.
It's here. There's a podium.
Yeah.
So I'll use it. But it's my honor to introduce Alan Sanocki. As Charles said, I'm Tygen Layton from the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, but also, more to the point, from Chicago Buddhist Peace Fellowship, who is co-sponsoring this event with DePaul University and the Religious Studies Department and the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies Department here. So it's wonderful to have Alan Sanocki in Chicago. He's been doing a few events here. And this part of his visit is especially important. So the title of the talk is Growing Vines of Engaged Buddhism East and West. And Alan has this extraordinary place in American Buddhism. He's a well, amongst many things, he's a very prominent Zen teacher in America. He's the vice abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, very involved in lots of ways in Zen Buddhist teaching in America. He's also a longtime musician, and so I wanted to mention that in the back of the room there are copies of his most recent CD called
Everything's Broken.
Everything is broken, and yet also we're all working to kind of mend it. But anyway, this is CD has a collection of Buddhistic songs from Alan, and it's really wonderful. And so they're available in the back, along with his wonderful book, The Bodhisattva's Embrace. So in addition to being a Zen teacher and a musician, Alan really has done extraordinary work in Buddhist activism and engaged Buddhism, all kinds of activism in America, but also particularly in Asia. So of all, there are other American Buddhists, of course, who've been involved in engaged Buddhism in Asia, but Alan has really been very active in Burma and all the struggles in Burma while Aung San Suu Kyi was in house arrest, meeting with people in Burma, going to the borders in Burma. He's going to talk about this and working with the situation there, and knows a lot about what's going on there now and the difficulties there. Alan's also worked in the community in India. There is an Indian Buddhism now in the last 50 years, for the first time since maybe around 1100. And Alan's working with the community of what has been called the Untouchables in India, an active Buddhist community. So he's actively involved in going to work there. So he knows a lot about that. Again, I wanted to mention Chicago Buddhist Peace Fellowship in our chapter. So there's a literature about that and a donation basket. So please support the work of Chicago Buddhist Peace Fellowship to bring speakers like Alan Sanaka here and to be involved in Chicago activism from a Buddhist perspective. And the other thing is that Alan was executive director of National Buddhist Peace Fellowship for a long time, but now has founded the Clear View Project, which works to bring Buddhist-based resources for relief and social change to Burma and India and other parts of Asia. So the Clearview Project also is worth supporting, and you can see his CD and his book. And so, Alan, please.
Thank you.
It's really wonderful to have you here.
Yeah. Thank you, Ty, again. Is it okay with you if I sit this way instead of behind the podium? I'm really happy to be back here with Chicago BPF. I was here a number of years ago. I think talking about Burma,
right.
And we'll have time to talk about Burma now, but my comments today will at least begin by being a bit more wide-ranging about engaged Buddhism. A couple of things occur to me right off the bat, which is just for people to understand that Chicago is one of the handful of really live chapters of Buddhist Peace Fellowship. Now, the Chicagoans may not know that, but I know it. And just to save a way of encouragement, please keep at it. And also, I really encourage you to be in contact with the BPF office in Berkeley, which is it's just organizationally and financially at a tricky place, and I think it would be great for you to be in contact with them. And they were really happy to hear. It's run by two women, Dawn Haney and Katie Lonk, who are young women. I like them a lot. Right now, they've been concentrating on, some of you may know about, this Buddhist pilgrimage or walk to the Alberta tar sands. And they've been involved in that. And I just want to sort of give a shout out for BPF. So having said that, let's just begin. If you just close your eyes and rest your hands lightly in your lap. And take a deep breath in through your nose and mouth. Breathe out slowly. And take some breaths like this. Let the air fill your body, moving down through your chest until it reaches your abdomen. And as you breathe out, follow the air as it slowly and steadily spins away from your mouth. You take this air in, which connects us to the whole world. And as you breathe out, you offer it back. And we are always doing this. And all beings are doing this simultaneously. So just taking the time here or at any moment through the day gives us an opportunity just simply to change our mind. So please remember, you can do this anytime. So now, as nice as it is to breathe like this, if you've traveled away in the last few moments, come back, open your eyes, and just notice from time to time, oh, I'm breathing. So I want to start with some words to frame this talk from two of our key teachers in this modern era. The first is Robert Aitken Roshi. I'll say more about both these teachers. Robert Aitken, in many ways, was seen as sort of the dean of American Zen teachers. He was a great teacher and a cantankerous guy. And he also was a really important engaged Buddhist. He was, in many ways, he was the founder of Buddhist Peace Fellowship. So late in his life, he wrote this book that I like a lot. It's called Zen Master Raven. Has anyone read it?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh good. Yeah, it's a very whimsical book, almost framed like in a sort of Native American kind of context, but a lot of what's in it is really to the point. So it's mostly spoken by these animals. So it's talking about the Eightfold Path, and Owl said, well, where does right realization come in? Brown Bear said, right view, right view. Owl said, what is right view? Brown Bear said, we're in it together and we don't have much time. That's the view. We're in it together and we don't have much time. The other thing I wanted to read by way of introduction is from some writing by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I think it actually appears in one of his earlier books from Parallax Press, Peace is Every Step. And when I started at Buddhist Peace Fellowship, someone in Berkeley, a printer in Berkeley, had made this section into a broadside and printed up 1,000 copies in beautiful letterpress. And it was titled, Mindfulness Must Be Engaged. So Thich Nhat Hanh writes, when I was in Vietnam, so many of our villages were being bombed. Along with my monastic brothers and sisters, I had to decide what to do. Should we continue to practice in our monasteries, or should we leave the meditation halls in order to help the people who were suffering under the bombs? After careful reflection, we decided to do both. To go out and help people, and to do so in mindfulness. We called it engaged Buddhism. He goes on, mindfulness must be engaged. Once there is seeing, there must be acting. Otherwise, what's the use of seeing? We must be aware of the real problems of the world. Then, with mindfulness, we will know what to do and what not to do to be of help. Are you planting seeds of joy and peace? I try to do that with every step. Peace is every step. Shall we continue the journey? I think that's succinct, personal, and very beautiful. And as we go on, we see that it speaks to very difficult choices. The fact that we are all in it together and we don't have very much time puts us in a really tight place. We need some spaciousness in order to know what to do to be effective and what to do that is just moving from our sense of alarm and urgency, which is, of course, understandable. So I wanted to try to frame socially engaged Buddhism and say first, you know, it's never exactly clear to me that there's something called engaged Buddhism as distinct from Buddhism. If you read the early Pali Suttas, you know, the Buddha was on his enlightenment. He said, you know, now I am enlightened together with all beings. He never did this alone. He always did it in relationship, in engagement, if you will. And, you know, the first thing he said about doing once he began teaching was to create a community and to create a very open community, certainly in the context of his age and place in India in the 5th or 6th century before the Common Era, he created a community that was open to people of all castes, of all occupations. In fairly short order, it included an ordination for women. This was all very radical. And the most radical thing, I think, in a context where one's whole life was socially determined by your gender, your caste, your occupation, your nationality, what he said is, no, the quality of your life is determined by your actions. And this is something we can do and examine together. So I'm not clear about this distinction. And having said that, what I think is of as engaged Buddhism is our Dharma practice that flows from an understanding of the complete and endlessly complicated interdependence of all life. It's the practice of the bodhisattva, the vow to save all beings. It's to know that my liberation and the liberation of other beings is inseparable. It's not something I can do by myself. And it's to work to transform myself as I am trying to be about the business of helping beings transform their relationships with each other and to the larger society. So, depending upon the needs and conditions, sometimes we're working from the outside in, you know, taking responsibility for ourselves, what we're thinking, feeling, and doing. And sometimes we're working from the inside out, taking responsibility for the world by our actions. So it's very fluid. It's seeing the world through the eye of the Buddha and responding empathically and actively. I think another dimension of it is to have a willingness to look at and see how deeply people suffer in the particular places where we live. Right here in Chicago, that's a place that we are now. In the United States, in the Northern Hemisphere, in the world, these are all places that we are inhabiting. And it's hard to really open our eyes and turn towards what's uncomfortable, towards what feels like it's beyond our ability to shift. But we have to be able to turn towards the suffering and to understand how we are involved in systems of suffering. And this is one of the things that I think is unique about a perspective that we call socially engaged Buddhism, is to understand that goes out from the Buddha's notion of dukkha as a mark of our existence, our individual existence, to the fact that we fashion whole systems and structures of suffering. We can call those structures racism or casteism or sexism. These are whole systems that we are invited into and that privilege us in different ways that create various fluid hierarchies of power and authority. So, can we see those systems and remember what Eiken Roshi said? You know, we're all in it together. So I'm remembering a friend, the editor and writer Barbara Gates, who edits Inquiring Mind. She was driving with her daughter Caitlin, who was very young at the time. She was like 6, and believe it or not, traffic in Berkeley can be really kind of exasperating. It can take a half hour to get up. You've been there. Take a half hour to get across Berkeley. You know, even though it's not a big place. And, you know, Barbara was just getting angrier and angrier, you know, about all the traffic. And I said, what's all this traffic, you know? And Caitlin from the car seat in the back said, but Mom, we're traffic too. You know, so we are all in it together. And this is how we are co-creating systems of suffering. So we're doing this locally. We do it in our communities, we do it in our families. And we do it globally. You know, I often think, you know, if we were really adventurous, I'd invite, I'd probably get in a lot of trouble for this, I'd invite everybody to take off your clothes and put them in a heap on the floor, and then we'd all rummage through them and just look at the labels and see how global we are, how interconnected we are, and how little we know about the lives of the people who are making our clothes, who are bringing us our food, who are drilling and pumping our oil. So the whole world is the place that we live in. So I think in almost every religious tradition, people have been integrating practices for faith and activism. Across these religions, and I guess this is the Interfaith Institute?
Yeah. Interfaith Engagement. Yeah.
Interfaith Engagement. There's a department for that here?
A center.
That's pretty good. You know, what we see, as Martin Luther King said, he said it was sort of gendered, his language, I am my brother's keeper because I am my brother's brother. So we could say we are our sisters and brothers' keepers because we are each other's sisters and brothers and allies. In the in the activity of being as most truly human as we can be. So those of us who are on this path, we draw on the present, we draw on our heroes, our archetypes. Tygen wrote a wonderful book called Faces of Compassion. Is that what it's called now? I have the old edition, which is called Bodhisattva Archetypes. But Faces of Compassion, which talks about the models of bodhisattvas as liberating beings, but the models drawn from different traditions and different activities that that are not explicitly Buddhist, but that are exemplifying and expressing these different archetypal manifestations of bodhisattva activity to help people, and so he includes artists, musicians, activists, sports figures, and so on. So we have these examples in the present, and we draw on these examples from the near and distant past as well. And it's also interesting that if we look at I'd like to talk about four, in the context of engaged Buddhism, four particular people, to just give you an overview. But I remember something that one of my teachers, the Thai Buddhist sort of activist philosopher Sulak Sivaraksa, pointed out in a talk, which was that all of our heroes, in a sense, have also been failures in the immediate, in a moment, you know. So transformative things that were set in motion, say, by Martin Luther King, we see them unfolding now. But although he's an iconic figure, looked at in the context of his time, he had some successes and he also had some real failures. And here in Chicago, at least in the immediate sense and in the long sense, I think set things in motion that continue to unfold. If you look at Gandhi succeeded in bringing about the end of a colonial rule in Great Britain, but at an incredible human price of partition, separation, ethnic conflict, or religious conflict. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who we love and respect as a great being, you know, after all these years, he has not yet succeeded in bringing together a harmonization of and the safety of his people, the Tibetans, in harmony with the Chinese. Now, the operative word in terms of these so-called failures is now, for now, because their actions as bodhisattvas continue to unfold into the future. So I just wanted to say that as a context, because of, it's natural that questions will arise about our own actions. And if people didn't dare to make these efforts, nothing would happen. So I wanted to talk about four people briefly, and then we'll sort of open up for discussion. The first person, as Taigen said, I've been working in India for the last 5 years or so. And I've been working with this community of Buddhists who were formerly designated as untouchables. That's untouchable within they live outside the caste system. And that's been, there's been just systematic oppression and violence against them in ways that I can go into, but it's hard to explain how complete that oppression is. How children are denied any kind of education, how, women are not allowed to draw water from the same wells as caste Hindus, how they're not allowed to enter temples. So what happened in the first half of the 20th century, there was a remarkable man named Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. And Ambedkar, he was born in the 1890s, in what is now the central Indian state of Maharashtra. And his family came from this untouchable caste background. And they were subject to intense economic and social discrimination. His father, however, was a non-commissioned officer in the Indian colonial army. So it's interesting. We look at these forces like colonialism, which we see as a, we'd like to think of as an unmitigated negative. And even within that, there are always, there are elements that allow for liberation. So Ambedkar's father was taught to read and write because he was in the army. And he was able, because he was in the army, he was able to find places at government school for his children. Even there, what that meant as Dalit or untouchable children, the children had to sit outside the schoolroom and learn their lessons through the window. And this is this is still the case in many parts of rural India. And they were ignored by their teachers. Ambedkar later reflected, my poor untouchable brothers live in a condition worse than slaves. Slaves were at least touched by their lords. Our very touch has been deemed a sin. And not even a British government has been able to do anything for us. But he was a brilliant student. And so in 1907, he was among the first untouchable youths to enter the University of Bombay, which was really top academic institution. And then, because he had a sponsor who was a ruler of a state who recognized his brilliance, he actually got a fellowship to study political science at Columbia in New York. Mm. And have you seen the statue to him there?
No.
There's a statue of Ambedkar on the Columbia campus. I think it was there when we were there, but we didn't know anything. So, and he went on. He got a PhD from Columbia. He got another PhD from the London School of Economics and was admitted to the British bar. So then he went back to his state of Baroda, where he had been promised a job. And when he went back as a lawyer, he worked in the state office for a time and then had to quit because his law clerks, his untouchability was such that they threw briefs and papers in the general direction of his desk. They just kind of threw them towards him, and he would have to pick them up. And finally, it was not a tolerable situation. He was a brilliant writer and thinker, he built a political movement of untouchables, and he had a very different and sometimes conflictual relationship with Gandhi. Gandhi, in many ways, was an anti-colonial activist, and Ambedkar was a human rights activist. He was like a civil rights activist. So his priority was not necessarily getting rid of the British. It was actually getting what he called, his principles were liberty, equality, fraternity, which he said was completely the message of the Buddha. He said, this is not the French Revolution, this is the Buddhist Revolution. To make a long story short, in the 1930s, what he said was, I was born Hindu, but I will not die Hindu. And he while he was doing his civil rights work, he threw himself into an investigation of all of the extant religious traditions in India, Christianity, Sikhism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. And he was being courted by all of these religions because he was the leader of tens of millions of people. And this was a powerful electoral bloc. And what he decided to do, by the late 40s, he had decided he was going to become a Buddhist. And Buddhism was virtually dead in India. So in 1956, all of the conditions that he had to set in motion, all that was in place, and he, in the city of Nagpur in like October of 1956, he converted to Buddhism. He took the three refuges, and he took the precepts, and he converted in front of 400,000 people. Mm-hmm. And then he turned around and he converted as a layperson, which is pretty radical, all of those 400,000 to Buddhism. He gave them the refuges and the precepts and began a conversion movement. And then he died 6 weeks later. There was nothing, there was no suspicion of, there wasn't a suspicious death. He was dying of congestive heart failure and diabetes. And that movement, the conversion movement, continued for a while, but there were very few Buddhist teachers. And I think that's all come in when I talk about what I've been doing now. There's an active Buddhist movement that is really rooted in Dr. Ambedkar's teaching, and it's big. You know, there's 100 million people who identify as Buddhist, and there are probably 15 or 20 million who are practicing Buddhism in India. And yet, how many of you know anything about this? It's almost invisible to the world, and I think that it's invisible because it's being done within the context of the most oppressed, and we don't see what's happening in the in communities of oppression. It's often invisible to us, so we can come back to that. So that's exemplar number one. Number two, you may have heard of, if Ambedkar's vision was about linking spirituality to a movement for the rights of the downtrodden people, then if we look to Sri Lanka, we look at the work of Dr. A.T. Ariaratne and a movement that he created, the Sarvodaya movement, which emphasized community development. So Ari, as he's known, was born in 1931 in Sri Lanka. He was born into a middle-class family and got a very good education. But his family was, they were Buddhist background. And he advanced through school very quickly and was hired as a science teacher at a Buddhist college, Nalanda College in Sri Lanka. And in his first year on his own, his first year as a science teacher, he surveyed the Sri Lankan untouchable communities that were living in terrible poverty. And the following year, he went to India and visited rural Gandhian communities that were still very much in place and that exist not so vitally now, but in the 50s they were still vital. And he met and traveled with one of Gandhi's famous disciples, Vinoba Bhave. And Bhave had formed a nonviolent social movement that was based on kind of redistribution of the land. And Bhave used this Gandhian term, Sarvodaya, which means for the welfare of all. And this vision deeply affected Ariaratne. So he returned to Sri Lanka and reflected on how these principles might actually guide actions of a communal act, communal activity. And he called this Shramadana, which means the gift of labor. So he formed this organization, Sarvodaya Shramadana, the gift of labor for the welfare of all. And his first act was to organize a work camp in an untouchable village with students and teachers from his school. And it was very successful. From those seeds, he built this organization, Sarvodaya, which has grown to be the largest grassroots development network in Sri Lanka. And it has, the network includes 15,000 villages, something like 6 million people, and many local offices. One thing I like that I think is really useful, we've learned from Dr. Ayaratne, is a tool that you can use that reframes the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths, as many of us know, you know, it's the truth of suffering, the cause of this suffering, the fact that there is an end to suffering, and the way to get to this end. So the truth of our lives being pervaded by suffering, not that all of our lives are suffering, but just that this unsatisfactoriness is something that we all carry, and we carry in our communities. Mm-hmm. The cause being, you could say the cause being desire or attachment, but it's just that we are, it's kind of, we want to get rid of what's uncomfortable, and we want what we like to exist forever. And neither one of those work. There is an end of suffering, which means not to be caught by that suffering. And there's a way to get there, which the Buddha describes as the Eightfold Path, which is just really a wholesome way to live. So Ari gave this a social interpretation that he used for investigating community problems. And I use this a lot. This is sort of in the some of the circles that I travel in. This is a basic Buddhist analytic tool that is useful in any situation. First of all, what's the problem? What's the cause of the problem? Or what are the roots of the problem? What does the solution look like? How do we get there? Now, the principles are very simple. And the devil may be in the details, but as a way of approaching circumstances in our life, I find myself coming back to this again and again. So Dr. Ayaratne is still alive. Sarvodaya is pretty healthy. He remains an inspiration for many people around the world. Third exemplar. Is Thich Nhat Hanh. You'll notice that so far all of these have been Asian teachers. I will say all of them also so far are male, which speaks to a certain patriarchal aspect of culture that we just can't get around. It's not that we don't have women exemplars. Tigan spoke to one of them on the phone about half an hour ago, Joanna Macy, who some of you may have seen here. She's one of them. But I wanted to say something about Thich Nhat Hanh because I think he he continues to be really important to us. We talked with a senior monk who is close to Thich Nhat Hanh, a monk in California now. His name is Thich Minh Duc. I don't know if any of you know him. But he said that he described the engaged movement in Vietnam as having three phases. The first phase in the 1930s was called Buddhism for Everybody, which was to bring Buddhist teachings and practices out of the monasteries to guide daily life. So to make it less, more something that was accessible to everybody, not something that was just the purview of monastics. The second phase, starting in the 1950s, which was in the midst of the war, of the anti-colonial war with the French after World War II, was called Buddhism Goes Into the World. And this was expressed through service to meet the basic needs of people, particularly refugees, because there was, with the war, there was a lot of displacement. So to provide shelter, food, education, and medical care. And then the third phase, as Thich Minh Duc expressed it, was getting involved, which started after the Buddhist crackdown, the crackdown on Buddhists in 1963. And this involved explicit activism that was intended to halt the persecution of Buddhists and also to stop the war, which was ramping up very, very quickly. So Thich Nhat Hanh, who was born in 1926, he participated in all three phases. After entering a monastery in Lue at the age of 17, evidently he rebelled against the limited monastic curriculum, and he moved to Saigon, where he could explore linking traditional Buddhism with contemporary literature and philosophy. He was always always had a really keen mind. So in the 1950s and 60s, he founded co-founded a number of organizations, including several centers for Buddhist studies and activism, the School of Youth for Social Service, the Thich Pien Order for practitioners of engaged Buddhism. He was also active in speaking and acting against the war. He came to the West in 1966, and during that time he met Martin Luther King and Thomas Merton and others. And if you listen to King's 1967 talk at Riverside Church, where he came out against the war, when I read that, I hear Thich Nhat Hanh's voice so clearly in the analysis and in the message that King was advocating. But during that time, while he was here in the West, Thich Nhat Hanh was advised by Buddhist leaders in Vietnam not to return out of fear of assassination or imprisonment. And so he began a long period of life in exile. So in exile, he and a number of his collaborators, particularly his disciple Sister Chong Kong, have articulated a very influential notion of what we call engaged Buddhism that really centers on a non-dual approach to transforming conflict. And this is not easy. And it has some basic elements. And I think they're linked to these Four Noble Truths in a very broad way. So the first is identifying the dualistic system of conflict. So Buddhist thinkers pointed to the roots of the war as a struggle between apparent polar opposites, communists versus Catholic versus capitalists, one superpower versus another superpower, to see that they were, that these were dynamics that were acting in the conflict. Second point is not taking sides. Very difficult. Strategy was to avoid, so you could say this is an expression of the middle way. The strategy was to avoid both extremes and pointing beyond dualistic conflict that didn't identify one side as the enemy and the other side as the friend. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, "The Vietnam War was first and foremost an ideological struggle. To ensure our people's survival, we had to overcome both communist and anti-communist fanaticism and maintain the strictest neutrality. Buddhists tried their best to speak for all the people and not take sides. And we were condemned as pro-communist neutralists." It's a very difficult position, not taking sides. In a sense, and we should talk about this, does it mean not taking sides? Or does it mean recognizing the human quality or the human essence of people on all sides of the struggle without necessarily supporting their view? So it's grounded, third point, grounding in the ethics of non-harming. This is expressing the Buddha's ethics, ethical precepts, and is a strategy towards peacemaking. Responding to suffering, which was just to help people on both sides of a conflict who are invariably experiencing the violence of that conflict. So to listen to them, to see them, to provide them with whatever resources are needed for simply for survival. And that the aim is reconciliation, not victory. And in that, I think you have to take the long view. That's been my experience. In an interview, this interview with Thich Nhat Hanh's student, Thich Minh Duc, he says, "For 100 years, we were controlled by the French. We knew that it would take a long time to untie that knot." So you have to keep that in mind, and keep in mind this is going to take a long time. This is not going to be a quick fix. So in the conflicts that we see, in the ones that I'm working with in India and close to in Burma, I don't think that you're going to undo tens and hundreds of years of conflict by a law or, just a few people changing their minds. You actually have to be in it for the long haul and allow the system to transform itself. So, the fourth exemplar who I've already quoted in our sort of family system of engaged Buddhism would be Robert Aitken. Aitken Roshi founded BPF on the back porch of the Maui Zendo in the middle 1970s. And originally, it was a gathering of practitioners who at that time were appalled by the proxy wars that America was fighting in Central America, that we weren't directly, we weren't sending troops there, but we were arming right-wing counter-revolutionary forces in these various countries who were committing atrocities, and we were supporting them with fairly substantial amounts of money, weaponry, training in, you know, if some of you know of the what used to be called the School of the Americas, and we were providing the infrastructure for reaction with a kind of plausible distance, you know, in its own way, similar to the drone program now. And you had a group of Buddhists who saw this is wrong. Our practice and vow of not killing, of saving beings, calls for us to step forward. And the first thing that they did was they thought they would organize a chapter of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a very well-respected nonviolent organization committed to nonviolence and to resistance. And the people at FOR said, well, we've got all these religious fellowships, you know, as sort of subgroups of the fellowship from the umbrella organization. So why don't you form a Buddhist peace fellowship? And they said, oh, well, that's a good idea. And they gathered Aitken Roshi and his wife, Ann Aitken, and Nelson Foster, who was one of his students then, as a Zen teacher, gathered their friends, who included Joanna Macy, Gary Snyder, Jack Kornfield, some of the Japanese American teachers, Tai Uno and Ryo Imamura, and others, into a loose grouping called Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And that continued, just to say that continued as a modest-sized organization with a good newsletter. And it's interesting, when I came in, I don't think it wasn't my doing, but I came in at a real turning time after BPF. Were you on the board then? Yeah. So it was like 1991. America was then headed into a hot war in the first Gulf War. And our membership soared, you know, from in the hundreds to in the thousands. And this was really gratifying to Aitken Roshi. He felt like something that he had set in motion was, the baby was growing up. The baby was also maybe wanting its own independence, but that's another story. But what he was always speaking for in his perspective, which was he had a background in sort of classical anarchism. And so he was maybe an unreconstructed wobbly. And so he was always talking about building the new within the shell of the old. I'm never sure whether that's possible or not, but he was our immediate inspiration, and is the continuing inspiration. BPF, there's a wonderful photograph of Aitken Roshi taken a few years before he died, holding up a sign with a big grin on his face that says, "The system stinks." And this has been an inspiration to the current BPF. So I wanted to lay out these things, and I think I will stop now. It's a little longer than I wanted to go, but I just felt these are some of the twining threads, and there are many more that outline the history, not just of BPF, but I think of engaged Buddhism in the West. So I'd like to open it for discussion, questions, whatever you have on your mind. Does that seem right? Okay. So we're open. Yeah.
The second and last person you spoke of, the first one was Dr. B.R. Ambedkar?
First was Dr. B.R. Ambedkar.
Ambedkar.
Yeah, A-M-B-E-D-K-A-R.
And the second person?
Dr. A.T. Ariaratne, A-R-I-Y-A-R-A-T-N-E.
And you had said they had pretty much simplified the four truths, and you said the first one was what's the problem?
Yeah.
And then the second one was?
What's the root of the problem? What's the cause of the problem?
And I needed three and four, I apologize.
Three is what's the solution? Or what does the solution look like? And the fourth is, how do you get there? Yeah.
Could you speak to the problem that Burma's experiencing with the Rohingya and the monks forcing them out and the rest of the country being against it?
Yeah. The rest of the country being against what?
Being against the Muslims
and
trying to turn them off.
This is an old, I just read there was an excellent piece, I think it's in The Economist today, pretty good analysis. Like almost everything in that part of the world, there's a colonial root to it. In this case, one of the things that happened was that when the British conquered, the British conquered Burma in three wars in the 19th century, and they created a country that had not been a country but had been a collection of small kingdoms that were relatively independent and had very tenuous relationships with each other. So when they brought in a colonial administration, they brought in a lot of Muslim Indians, and they ran it for the British. And so you had an antagonism not necessarily towards them as Muslims in an immediate sense, but as the colonial enactors. And so one of the things that happened is when Burma became independent after World War II, they actually expelled a lot of the Indians. But by that point, there was a large population, that were already there. That's one point. Another element is that the Burmese military junta made a point of identifying itself as Buddhist, even though it was repudiated by some of the Buddhists, and there was an active Buddhist movement opposed to the junta. But they courted favor, they built temples, and what they were basing their rule for many years on the construction of a Buddhist national identity. So there were many ethnic conflicts that were hot wars in Burma with the Kachin, the Karen, the Shin, the various states that are on the periphery of Burma many of them were not Buddhist. They were animist or Christian. Or, you know, in this case, they were Muslims also. So they've been in 1995, I think, there was a huge expulsion of Rohingyas who were ethnically Muslim. About 200,000 of them were pushed over the border into Bangladesh. And then gradually they filtered back in. But my sense is, for whatever reason, in the process now of so-called liberalization, it's very much like what you see in certain parts of Eastern Europe, or what you're seeing in Iraq, or you're seeing in various places where they're having the Arab Spring. When you remove the oppressive superstructure, then conflicts that were there from earlier times have an opportunity to flower, you know, because the pressure's off, and this is what I think is happening now in Burma, and so it's being, you know, it's being led by a kind of what I find really problematic is this kind of Buddhist nationalism, and you know, you're seeing a rising of this also in Sri Lanka now. And you're seeing the proliferation of anti-Muslim movements in different places, in Thailand, in Malaysia, in Sri Lanka, in Burma. And it's also playing into whatever forces may be there for a radical Islamic movement. And so what you see is the violence is ramping up. And, you know, the people who are progressive monks and progressive Buddhists are, they don't feel really, they're not getting much play in the press, and they don't feel encouraged to speak out. And some of the political forces, which is disappointing, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi is no longer an icon. She's a political candidate. There's a difference. You know, if you're an icon where you've been excluded, you know, then you can say almost anything and stand on a principle. But if you're in politics, you watch what you say. And so many people feel quite disappointed that she's been very guarded in her comments. So that's a very quick picture. But there are things happening under the surface that we don't hear about that I feel, you know, they're encouraging, but we don't know which way this is going to go. It really depends. You know, it's going to vary according to the degree of violence that is perpetrated on both sides. So, right last week or the week before, probably as kind of blowback from the oppression of Muslims in Burma, you had bombs set off in Bodh Gaya around the temple where the Buddha was, enlightenment was marked. And it's like, the more this kind of shit happens, the more dug in both sides are going to be. And that worries me a lot. And I think, you know, people ask, Well, Jack, you were talking about it, right? I don't know if you got your... Is your letter been drafted?
Well, what Ellen's referring to is 60 Dharma teachers in Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition wrote a follow-up letter to Ashin Muratu, the lead monk who's been using the language that's been viewed as inflammatory by the Western press, asking, as the Dalai Lama did, and as Thich Nhat Hanh did in December, to, you know, look deeply at what they're saying is contributing to the violence. And where things stand, I talked to a person who's been very helpful in the State Department on Friday. They have the funds to bring Thich Nhat Hanh in to try to mediate the situation. So I asked Thich Nhat Hanh and Sister Chong Kong if there's any interest. We have to bear in mind Thich Nhat Hanh's age, energy level, and commitments. And the other thing that the State Department would be interested in doing and paying for would be, if Thich Nhat Hanh can't do this, would be prominent representative from the Theravada tradition. So we can discuss that.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government is trying to be helpful in its own way, but there are limits to what any of us can do.
Right.
But Thich Nhat Hanh's attitude was that we do need to try something. You know, he and Sister Chong Kong were amused that these monks were not listening to the Dalai Lama or to Thich Nhat Hanh. But they do believe that if enough Western people support something called the Saffron Robe Association, which is sponsoring speakers to counteract every time Ashin Muratu speaks, there's been kind of a counterweight developing. And there's a sentiment in the U.S. State Department that these more moderate monks enjoy.
Yeah, well, I would like to talk about that more, because I think that's... The solution is probably going to be, it will have to be an internal one. That's my feeling. But I have thoughts about the Theravada facilitator. That's a really interesting idea. But even there, you know, you're dealing with a situation of tremendous ethnocentrism. So these aren't just Burmese monks. They're Burman Burmese monks. So they're from the dominant ethnic group, and they see themselves as the sons of Buddha. And so they're quite an elite. And they're not really interested. They're certainly not interested in Mahayana figures, which would, as much as we might respect Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama, it doesn't necessarily compute to them. And so it's very tricky. But there might be other people who could be helpful. And the idea of supporting... I'd like to know more about this Saffron Robe Society. If the idea of supporting them is entirely feasible, and that's something that we could do. It's not so much our opinions are going to make much difference, but making resources available could very well. Yeah.
I think there's a lot more to say about Burma. I wanted to throw in a little different question that came up for me when you talked about Thich Nhat Hanh's approach to not taking sides as an engaged Buddhist strategy and a non-dualistic approach to allow the system to transform itself. And you mentioned Eikin Roshi and the founding of Buddhist Peace Fellowship having to do with the struggles in Central America. And so one just overarching issue that I see for us as American engaged Buddhism is just the extent of corporate rule.
Right.
And the, the fossil fuel companies and the weapons merchants and others, the big banks, basically enforcing climate change and the destruction of our environment and our economy for their personal profit. So at what is an engaged, an American engaged Buddhist response? And, you know, so you're, somehow the idea of not taking sides struck me. How does one, you know, to speak about that from the Dharma seat, which I try to do sometimes, is challenging. How to speak about it without, you know, in a way that is positive, that is encouraging rather than just fault finding. And so how do we, but, and yet there's this huge problem for the future of, you know, our species at least, and the habitat of the future. And so, I don't know, I'm just interested in any reflections you have on
that. Well, I want to step back to talk about this not taking sides. Because I think that that was a principle that existed in the context of the war in Vietnam. And if you think about the other thing I was going to say about the using the Four Noble Truths, another technique I've been working with some friends is what's called conflict mapping, where you look at a conflict and you look at all of the players in that conflict, all of everybody who is involved in the conflict, and you look more deeply into that conflict and see what's the motivation for them. So, say, what you're seeing, this came up in India, what you're seeing was a conflict between Maoists and indigenous people where they were killing each other in one of the rural provinces in India. Well, it was about control of land. And then when you look more closely, what you see is that what was happening was that a copper mine was making huge incursions into cropland in this province and was sort of driving. So the interest that was really being served by the Maoists and the tribals killing each other was the interest of the copper mine and the copper corporation. So when you do a kind of conflict mapping, you're looking at who are the actual people who are who have interest in this conflict. And in a sense, if I look at Vietnam, this is just my sense, and you know, other people here who have studied this might have a different perspective. It made no sense in the war in Vietnam for Thich Nhat Hanh to take sides with the communists or with the Americans. Those were not sides to pick. And if you aligned with one of them, you know, there was you were making a mistake. You know, so if you aligned with people who wanted peace, you know, who wanted some kind of harmonious relationships, that's one element of it. The other thing in non-alignment or not taking sides means I think this is in line with what we see in, particularly you see in the Kingian movement. They very clearly took sides, but he didn't create enemies of individuals. You know, what he would recognize is there are humans on both sides of this conflict who are motivated by all the things that humans are motivated by. And so you may, you know, basically said, never hate a person, but you can take a stand against that person's views, or that person's actions. So how we do this is very difficult and subtle. You know, how do you treat someone that you have, whose actions you may have contempt for, how do you treat them respectfully? And I think it really is incumbent upon us to do that, you know, and this is why one of the things, I mean, I didn't talk about it, I feel like in Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching, you know, he made a sort of retrenchment at a certain point, or it appeared to be, where he started working with families. You know, he started working at the lowest possible social unit, because that's where we learn how to or how not to deal with conflict. I don't know if that's, does that make sense?
I can add one interesting thing to the mix. Over the years, I've had a chance to talk to some of the young seers. That's what Thay used to call the young lay Buddhists. As you might expect, a number of them are still alive. And they're in their 80s, but they look like they're in their 50s. They still have this young gleam in their eye, notwithstanding what they went through during the Civil War days. But I once asked about these bewildering 14 mindfulness trainings, because they seem to be saying different things from time to time. And there's one warning about being involved in partisan conflicts. And the insight that I gained from, I think, two of these people was you had to understand that there were still elections in Vietnam during this era, and the Buddhists did have their own party.
Yeah.
And so there was a sort of a manipulation of the Buddhist vote that Thich Nhat Hanh and his followers were very suspicious of ever being swept up
into. Right.
So it's that kind of resistance to pandering that's being referred to there. But if you look at the other 14 mindfulness trainings, you know, they're very provocative. On the one hand, they're warning against ideology and misperception. That's clear. And that's probably the most unique.
It's like the first one, isn't it?
First three are all wrapped up in those. But then it proceeds, and most people don't hear this part of the message, you know, do not allow killing to occur.
Right.
Speak out against situations of injustice, even at your own risk. People in the West are missing this part of his message.
Right.
And so it's not, I think you're absolutely correct, Alan, but I'll take that on. However, is always mindful of right speech and will not use an Alinsky tactic by demonizing the opposition.
Right.
That will never occur.
Right.
It will never occur.
Right. And that's a technique. So this is where I think there's a distinction. There are things we can learn from the Saul Alinsky model, but it's a tactical model that depends on really working with opinion and with states of mind, but it's willing to go into areas that are pretty dicey. Yeah.
So I think this is related to where the discussion has been going, but as I see the strengths of Buddhism in terms of engagement, it's really what you were discussing about practices that enable you to be sustained engagement for the long haul. Particularly, but then I'm also mindful that both you and Tagen had articles in a book called A Buddhist Response to the Climate Emergency. And the term climate emergency hits home, and it's not the long haul. It's the short haul that we're facing. So I'm not quite sure how a tradition that really works well at the long haul, how does it deal with something that's a more immediate crisis?
Well, Gary Snyder has a way of addressing that, which I like, and I think the climate emergency is a good case in point. He talks about that the situation is so bad that we have to act as if our hair's on fire, and at the same time we have to act as if we have all the time in the world. So the way to act when it's an emergency is just when things are really bad is to slow down in a way. We can't just rush around, because that doesn't lead to anything. So it's paradoxical in a way, maybe, but that's just my immediate response, that it is an emergency. Obviously, there's the photos of the North Pole like a lake now. So, you know, it's pretty serious. And yet, so I don't know how we get the government and the corporations and so forth to actually do the things, the major things that need to be done, and yet we have to sustain for the long haul calling for that. I don't know. Could you connect to that?
I don't know. I'd actually like to hear other voices. Yes.
And having thought about it, just that, you know, something a lot of people, you know, think about with this is just focusing on the process as well as the goal, you know, just how you do what you do. I feel like that's obviously where a Buddhist, you know, mindset can help to guide right action in the short term, which, you know, helps set you up for the long term as well, but...
Yeah, how you do things is really important.
Like, even if you're in an emergency mode, you know, trying to do my...
Well, this is what, you know, one of our teachers, a guy named Katagiri Roshi, always used to talk about emergency case. It was an expression of his. And what that means to me is, in an emergency, you're going to do what you're trained to do. This is why we call Buddhism training. If you know CPR, you know, you're going to know what to do in a situation where somebody has cardiac arrest in front of you. If you don't, you might stand there with your mouth agape. But if you're trained, you will do what you're trained to do, and you can only do what you're trained to do. If your car goes into a skid, you know, if you don't know what you're, if you don't know what that's, you know, your intuitional response may very well be turn out of the skid, which is going to mean you're going to lose control of your car. To do the what may seem counterintuitive, which is turn into the skid, to actually regain control of your front wheels, is a matter of training. So we're training in this in the wide way.
I just wanted to speak again to this issue, like, not taking sides, because and maybe what I'm about to say is not going to be very popular, and that's okay, but I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, it seems to me like you know, we have an old song, "Which Side Are You On?" In the American left, and it seems to me like if you're going to be engaged, it actually means taking a side.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, maybe not to get, I don't know where exactly to go with this, but I would say, you know, looking at the example of Vietnam, that I think it was a good thing that the U.S. was defeated in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because it made it politically untenable for the U.S. to start another large-scale war for several decades, you know, at least until, you know, and of course they went ahead, with Iraq anyway, and they're going to do that. But it did send a message that even though, you know, here's the most powerful, destructive military on the face of the earth, they were defeated by poor peasants who were trying to, you know, and it made a difference. And, you know, there were, I think that we need to be kind of subtle about who is potentially on our side, and you know, and kind of have an expansive idea of that, because if you're on the side of social justice, then, you know, the vast majority of people in the world are potentially on the same side, you know. And in the case of Vietnam, you know, I would have a lot of problems with the Vietnamese Communist Party, but I think that they were actually leading a genuine national liberation movement. And in that context, you know, I would have been on that side, not to say that I would agree with everything that they were for, but, you know, a lot of U.S. soldiers even, you know, rebelled against their own officers and sided with the Vietnamese in that context, which means, you know, that... Anyway.
Yeah. No, I understand. I don't have a fundamental disagreement with that. The tricky thing is to look at, as I said at the beginning, the tricky thing is actually to look at ourselves and see where, you know, what is seen and unseen about our self-interests, our national interests, and not to, and to recognize where we may be shaped by ideas that are somehow being sold to us. I don't know, but I think we have to help each other see through it. Yeah.
Well, speaking of the Vietnam War, it's, and I don't know if I'm getting too small on the issue, but when there's demonstrations or, you know, when you see, like, I come from a police family, when the cops show up, everyone turns their anger to the police.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not there to be, they're not representing the other side. They're there so you don't, you know, trash the place or kill each other or kill somebody, you know. They're there to keep the peace, really, even though they have guns and, you know, mace, and they get out of control, too.
Right.
But it's like people, you know, go after them. And then with the Vietnam War, people went after the soldiers when they came home. They treated them like dirt. And I kind of have, you know, with the whole, we want to protest Blue Angels. It's like the Blue Angels are, you know, those guys are altruistic. I mean, not the pony guys that fly around, but it's, you know, they're a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the soldiers that are, you know, they those guys, when they join the army, are trying to help.
Yes.
That's in their mind. They're like, my dad did it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, we want to attack the soldiers, not the guys, the politicians that are like, go over there and get that oil, you know.
Right.
So,
one thing that, you know, I'm reminded of when you were speaking is Tigan and I were arrested at the beginning of the Iraq War, right? At the federal building. And one of the, you know, it was not a wild confrontation.
Right.
And I've been in those. But what we had agreed, we were going to treat the people who were arresting us as respectfully as we could. And what was really interesting, you know, we were able to do that. That was using our privilege. We had some privilege there, and so did they. But we used it to create a connection, and we did connect, you know, because there were people among the arresting officers who were very, very explicit in communicating that they were actually in agreement with us. And to the extent that one can do that, this is a very difficult principle of nonviolence training. It's very hard to keep your composure when you're facing violence. But if you can, you may still lose, but at least, you know, at least you've kept your respect. You kept your respect for yourself and your respect for the other person as a human being. Even though they may be manipulated by virtue of their job or their position by other people whose interests are being served. It's not the police's interests that are being served by, you know, by conflicts. It's actually, it goes up the system. So, yeah, I think this is where respect is a fundamental principle.
So, I mean, that played out for some of us who were old enough to be in the trenches then, trained in some nonviolent responses. The peace movement itself was deeply divided. And
yes.
Part of those who promoted a more dualistic frame LBJ, LBJ, how many kids did you
get? Yeah, I was among them, just to be clear with you.
But what it did was, not only did it create enemies of the other, but these folks were manipulating others of us in the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think Dr. King had a fundamental thing about the difference, he quoted Buber, between an I-it relationship and an I-you
yeah.
relationship.
I there, yeah.
That dualism also were people trying to take hostage the peace movement itself to create people storming the barricades of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, just to say, I think there can be a taking sides, as you were saying, which I agree with, and also respecting everyone, including soldiers, policemen. You know, it's not the soldiers. The soldiers who go over there, I agree with you, go, you know, are in most cases doing this out of some sense of serving their country and are worthy, you know. So just going back to what you were saying about respect and not hating persons, it's the systems of that lead to these conflicts that are the problem. So you can take a side without,
yeah.
You know, and this is what, you know, Alan and I and others who were in the anti-Vietnam movement who did take sides in a kind of disrespectful way and learned from that that anger doesn't help anything, mm-hmm. That kind of anger, and to peaceful, I don't know if you want to say Buddhist, but non-violent kind of way of taking sides where there is respect, and that's got to be the basis for any kind of mature, helpful taking sides.
But
and it's not about the soldiers; it's about the forces that are causing harm.
But I want to be clear about something: that in a non-violent movement, and you would call it active nonviolence. The task is actually to surface the conflict that's actually already there. So it's to surface. It's the task in the investigation of the Four Noble Truths is to surface the problem. And this is what you find, you know, if you look at the example of Gandhi's Salt March,
yeah.
If you look at many of the actions within the civil rights movement, if you look at other symbolic nonviolent actions, the idea is to bring forth, is to show, actually there's violence going on here. And to have the strength and training to receive that violence, which is very, very difficult. You know, so this is nonviolence training has often involved role play, where, you know, people are spitting on you, insulting you, maybe beating you, and you are trying to maintain your composure, not in your presence is oppositional, and your presence is catalyzing the conflict, but you are not retaliating. And that's one of the strategies of a nonviolent movement. And you see that if you look at it, you know, what you're modeling there is both non-retaliation and non-cooperation. You know, you're manifesting your opposition to this action or this system, but not doing it by countering violence with violence, but actually doing something much more difficult, which is to allow oneself to not to move. This is actually just like Zazen. What?
Passive.
No, it's not passive. That's why it's called active. Because it's called active because it's very hard. It's not just passive. It's like what our attitude is in seated meditation. We sit there. It may not be a great example, but you sit cross-legged for a while. Your knees are going to hurt. everybody will experience this. So, okay, my vow is I'm not going to move for this period of meditation. You know, then I'll get up and move. But I'm not going to be pushed out of my seat by my pain. And that is an active, not a passive principle. Does that make sense? And so to do that, to have that kind of principle and composure within a situation of conflict is really challenging. Yeah.
I was going to say, I really appreciate that, that you gave us so much time for conversation, that, you know, that I feel like we've kind of gotten into some of the real complexity of what it means to do, to engage,
yeah,
you know, in a real and thoughtful way with the issues, you know, of the world, that it's not, you know, having compassion in a kind of general way and trying to serve, it sounds good and it's really inspiring, but when you actually get into it, it's really confusing and hard. And I appreciate also that, you know, you starting off with the speaking to the issue of failure, and, you know, any of us who've been involved in trying to serve, I imagine, I know I have experienced a sense of failure and mm-hmm. a sense of confusion and not knowing, you know, what the impacts are of our actions and whether we're making good choices. Yeah, and so I did, and it was also coming up for me the issue of just this ongoing, the need for ongoing questioning and curiosity, you know, that there isn't sort of a stance that you find in a situation and then that's it. It's like as if you found the right answer and the right way to be and the right way to handle it. You know, that these situations keep evolving and we keep learning from mm-hmm. other people. We keep, you know, if you really listen to the other side and you really start to hear the complexity of the points of view on the so-called other side, you know, that it moves you and changes you and your position evolves and you develop other ways of thinking about where you want to position yourself and how, you know, what it means to serve. So, anyway, I just appreciate the complexity of the conversation.
Yeah. We have time for one or two more. Was there something? Yeah.
I just wanted to mention in the context that everybody's talking about that next Friday, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, next weekend they're having their convention here. And I'm not sure if this organization is one of the sponsors, but I know some other nonviolence and peace organizations are. And they're going to be having speakers. One of the speakers is, I think, from Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And it's the topic is about U.S. militarization, and I think they're just trying to really understand what is it, what's behind the Iraq War. And
great.
It sounds like it would be very good.
It's at the Chicago Temple,
right.
77 West Washington.
Is that, was the person we heard on the radio yesterday?
Yeah, that was him. Yeah,
boy, he was great.
He was.
Somebody Kramer, I think. I know it's time for our official close. Can I read you something? That's apropos of this last point. And this is actually at the end of my essay, The Bodhisattva's Embrace. I came across, and I'm sorry, this may be a hard place to end. But we don't have to run out. But I wanted to share this story because it just, it's always with me. I came across a profound story in Taylor Branch's Pillar of Fire, the second book in his three-volume history of America in the Age of Martin Luther King. Three civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Schwerner, were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in Neshoba County, Mississippi, in June of 1964. Klan member Horace Burnett later gave a confession to the FBI. Burnett described the events of that terrible night. By the side of a country road, Alton Wayne Roberts pulled Mickey Schwerner out of the rights worker's car. He put a gun to Schwerner's head, saying, "Are you that nigger lover?" Schwerner replied, "Sir, I know just how you feel." Mm-hmm. Schwerner and his co-workers were shot and buried beneath an earthen dam. A bodhisattva practices without regard for success or failure. Civil rights workers in Mississippi were thoroughly trained in the practice of nonviolence. So Schwerner could say, "Sir, I know just how you feel." But what did he mean? Did he understand Wayne Roberts' fear or his hatred? Were they in fact Mickey Schwerner's own feelings? We will never know. Schwerner's compassionate response did not save his life, but the karma of his words is still unfolding. Because of his courage, a man confessed to these murders. And we are still studying these words and actions, vowing to make them our own. So thank you very much. And it's really been good to be here with you this afternoon. Dean, yeah.
Thank you. Excuse me very much for this wonderful afternoon discussion. There are books in the back and T-shirts from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship.
Donation basket.
Sign-up sheet if any of you want to be on, be aware of future events of the Center for Interreligious Engagement, and also a Buddhist Peace Fellowship sign-up sheet right outside the door. So thank you all for coming.
Thanks, Cheryl.
And I think Alan's happy to stay here a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You don't have to leave, but for those who may need to leave now at 4:30, there are the books that he was just reading from, Alan's book, 47 and Grace, and his CDs that are very fine. And you can make checks out the Clearview Project, so those are back there too. But I'd recommend you take a look at those.
Thanks for having me.